and welcome to Reanimated. Ladies and gentlemen, this is episode 254. We are continuing our review series today of the Deadlands television show on Shudder and various and sundry other locations. But Shudder's where it's at for us American types for now. And before we get into that, I should introduce my other better half of the co-hosting scenario, and that is H.A. Conrad.
Bonjour.
Oh, enchanté. We will do the podcast in Franglish today, which is French, Spanish, and English.
You invoked the écouté.
When we were having technical difficulties, I like to try and troubleshoot in multiple languages. I find that it helps.
Yeah, I hear you.
So, ni hao, and let's do this. In the news, there's not a lot, because I think we're starting to finally get to the tail end of no production going on in this country for months and months and months. I feel like there's going to be a long desert of discontent happening here pretty soon. A lot of rumor mill about The Walking Dead, and very little else about like actual production for other shows and movies. One of the things that is coming up at the end of July is the Comic-Con at Home, at which there will be, I assume, Zoom conversations with Scott Gimple and a bunch of other people behind the scenes for Walking Dead Prime, Angela Kang, and then a bunch of actors. And then they're also going to have panels. Gosh, that's a hard word to remember. Panels with Nicotero, Norman Reedus, Melissa McBride, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, Loan Cohan, Josh McDermott, Ross Marquand, and Paola Lazzaro, who is Princess. Have we talked about? Yes, we have. We've talked about her. Is this the kind of thing that would tickle your interest?
I mean, I think you got to be somewhat creative when it comes to all of this right now. I think everybody's trying to do their best to try to at least continue these things going. Also, look, there's like not a ton of new content coming out. I mean, we're waiting for some of this, obviously, for Walking Dead, the finale and all of that kind of thing, and maybe for some new news about some of the little spinoff series. So, you know, I think it allows more people to maybe participate and put some stuff out there. I think you have somewhat of a captive audience for the most part. So, hey, I think you got to do what you got to do. And if they didn't do this, there would just be sort of silence. So yeah. I kind of understand their reasoning behind it.
They've kept some of the hype going with their new podcast. Well, it's not really new anymore, but it's about 9 months old. Their podcast, Talk Dead to Me, which is run by their like social media coordinator and a couple of other people at Skybound. And so they've been doing interviews with folks off and on or throughout the pandemic remotely. Still no release date for the finale, although apparently one exists because Bobby Kirkman talked about it in some interview he did. He said, there's a date, but I don't think it's public yet. I don't know. Some of the stuff we read early on in the spring led me to believe that there were just a couple of days left of pre-production or post-production before release was going to be feasible. So I think they're holding on to it now, maybe pending some other stuff, because LA and Georgia are both in production mode, as far as I can tell. There's some union stuff, and there are massive spikes in Georgia and California, but California's basically given up on COVID, and we're just moving forward.
Yeah, it seems like it. You know, I think it seems like a lot of states are doing that, but then some are backtracking. I mean, as of yesterday, there was almost 45,000 new infections. And it's like, that's the fifth day in a row of a daily horrible record. And the places where it's up are Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and Nevada, all setting sort of new record highs. And then, you know, I saw that the governors of Florida and Texas, who had been, quite frankly, cavalier about this whole thing and had been, you know, basically giving New York a hard time and saying, oh, well, we can manage this in the way that we're going to manage it, have all now backtracked on some of the things that they were saying. I don't know if you caught the weird Florida town hall meetings where the mask wearing issue was up, and people were saying that if you wore a mask, it was like the directive of the devil, and things like that. And
I've seen
you
this,
know, I would
unfortunately, in
say,
California too. This is not a Floridian thing.
yeah.
I wish it was a Florida man story, but it's not.
Well, no, I only use that example because that's the footage that I
Yeah.
saw, but
And they've been cutting that into
basically.
Parks and Rec episodes. Have you seen that?
No, I have not.
Just so
But
that Leslie Knope is having to listen to the insanity and, pretend that people are caring loudly at her, that kind of thing.
it made me wonder, well, gosh, during how is this different than other times? Is this different than how other countries are sort of dealing with this? And the answer is, well, sort of and sort of. But basically, there was a similar backlash against mask wearing during the 1918 flu pandemic. And there was, you know, people have pulled up articles from like San Francisco and things like that. So it's not a new thing. I think in a country like the US, where people pride themselves on individualism, there is unfortunately, I think, less of a, I don't know, like a social contract, that people feel like they should be looking out for each other, which is unfortunate. Like there's not a collective. And this is, you know, there's some good things about that in the US, but this is a particular case where I feel like the politicization of all of this is crazy because it's a freaking pandemic. This isn't about freedom, it's about keeping people alive. And it's not like, I don't know, I just find this somewhat upsetting but also fascinating because it's just, to me, it's sort of like, well, they've proven that the mask works, so I don't really understand why you wouldn't wear it. So. Somebody basically said, I think maybe John Stewart, and he was saying, well, you know, let's just talk about this in the context of like hospitals. Doctors wear masks, they wash their hands so that people, you know, so that there's a sterile environment. You know, do you then say, oh, well, you know what? I'm not believing this study. Go maskless and don't wash your hands, and, you know, I'll take my chances of having like surgery. And I mean, look, I think that that's a good like analogy, which is just like this is just something, a very small thing that everybody could do to stop the infections and to at least slow the spread. Because I mean, it's not foolproof, but it's the best thing we have right now. So anyway, I'm kind of like tired of that. I've been watching New York open up a little bit, and I will say Cuomo's been a little bit too cocky, in my opinion, about how well New York is doing, because I've been looking at all the bars and all the things that happening here. They've been doing this thing here, which the restaurants are allowed to basically open up different parking spots, sort of like off of the sidewalk of the restaurants, to set up tables and stuff for people to eat outside versus inside because they're not allowed in indoor dining yet. And they have those tables packed so closely together that I don't think you might as well be inside. So I am guessing we will see an uptick here too. And you know, my thing is with all of this is like the longer that we keep sort of acting as if it's not happening and that everybody's just tired of staying inside and all of that, the longer this is going to go on until we find a vaccine. And maybe that is how it goes, but I thought somewhat disturbing was the age groups of the people that are newly infected, which has lowered significantly. Like the median age is around, like, I think the biggest spreaders at this point, or the newest infections, are like ages like 18 to 35, versus the median earlier was like 60 plus. So, and then, of course, you run the risk of these younger people going home and infecting people that are a lot more vulnerable, like their grandparents and stuff like that. So anyway, we'll see what's happening. I'm glad the infections are coming down in New York, but they're still not at zero. I mean, they're like statewide, I think they were in like the 600s yesterday, which is not nothing, but it's much
Well,
better than where our peak was.
it's a lot better than
Yeah.
most, well, a lot of other
Yeah.
states in the US,
And
for
look, I've been
sure.
talking to friends of ours in Texas, and it's just disheartening. Nobody's wearing masks, and there's, you know, just it's pretty rough there. They did say that they are closing down the bars again, when they had opened them before, and so that's at least something. But you know, if, as I said, if the behavior that I've seen here in New York is any indication, I don't know that that's going to make that much of a difference if people are just outside hanging out, you know. So anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that right now. Do you have anything to add? How are you feeling in California?
Fine. I mean, my life hasn't changed that much. We're not going out. Stuff is maybe open, but the extent of my reopening in my personal life is I walk to the farmer's market, which is an outdoor market, and buy things with dirty money. Just have to take the hand sanitizer with you, I guess. And then, on a very personal note, my son had a fever last week, and so we took him on Friday for a COVID test, which made him cry.
Oh, 'cause I hear they're pretty intense.
Yeah, they go right up into your nose, all the way up. So that was tough, and I don't think he has it, but he had, he had some loose poops and had a
Yep.
fever for a few days. I was like, well, that's two off the list. I feel like, one by itself, maybe you ignore. Two, you go. The
Yep.
argument against, and our pediatrician was saying, like, oh, it's fine. He probably is fine. And I think that the reason why they can be that way, although that's been kind of my experience with pediatricians, is, oh, it's fine. Like, the entire time I've been a parent is trying to persuade my pediatrician that my kid is actually sicker than they are. But it's because of contact tracing. Like, we typically know where our hotspots are in my county anyway, because we've got hundreds, like, I think over 100 contact tracers working on following up on active cases. And so through that, we have a general sense of where hotspots are. And if there's not an expectation that they're in my town or in my part of the county, then people will say, like, oh, it's not a big deal. Either way, this is
And
part
you
of
don't have
living
the
with
results
COVID.
back yet?
No,
You
it
don't have the
was,
results back?
it's like 24 to 48 hours. And I don't know if they don't do it as much over the weekend. I'm
Well,
hoping we get it today
I.
so he can, if he gets a clean bill of health, he can go back to camp, which might sound silly,
Right.
but otherwise we don't get work done.
Yeah, I hear you. Interestingly, so my sister-in-law just got word there in Virginia. And they got word that they have two options this fall for school. One is 100% homeschooling. The other is that the kids go in 2 days a week,
Yeah, we've got the same exact one here. Same
and they
model.
split the and they split the week between, you know, so they're basically splitting up the classes to limit the number of kids. So if they were to do it, it would be like Monday and Wednesday, or, you know, Tuesday and Thursday, whatever half their classes are in. And, you know, at this point in time, I think they're able, it's been pretty rough just from a working point of view. So I think they're going to go with the 2 days. But they're lucky enough that, you know, there's at least one of them that's able to watch the kids. And when they're not being, you know, when they are being homeschooled or whatever. And, but lots of people are not in that position. So it's going to be an interesting fall, to say the least. Again, my job is still holding steady in terms of the working remote piece. And I mean, right now I'm feeling like we may not go back till January based on what it appears to be sort of the, basically they said if we are going to go back, it would be kind of similar to what they're talking about with the kids, which is only if it's safe. And then it would be like splitting up the office into different shifts, basically. So you would go in a couple of days a week and, you know, be home a couple of days a week or whatever it was. But I think they're almost rather they're, they would almost rather to keep everybody out of there because they just feel like it's too risky. So I get that. But it doesn't. And, you know, we also have the same issue here because we don't know what's going to happen in the fall with the schools, and we have a ton of people with kids, and they don't know what they're going to do from a childcare point of view. So it's really tough to figure out all these issues.
Yeah, and
All the parents I know are losing it. So.
I mean, that was me 2, 3 weeks ago before this camp opportunity started up, and our schools are looking at exactly the same model, either 100% remote or 2 days in, and then making up the childcare portion, or at least they're asking in surveys, like, would you just handle the childcare or would you hire somebody, or would you take advantage of a city-provided childcare, after school, whatever, like, you know, homework, homeroom type scenario. And that's just for people who can't not work or are unable to do childcare during the work week, during the work day, it's going to be an additional cost also. Like, this isn't going to be free childcare, obviously. And so that's going to be a problem, especially when the cost of doing things like that with the prevailing wage in California is going to be something like almost a grand a month. And that's just an additional cost that people can't necessarily bear.
Whoa. Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see what happens. But still kind of a weird world we're living in. And I think we just kind of have to move forward. I mean, Bill and I, my husband and I are like one of the things that just feels kind of, again, this is like we're in a very privileged position because I'm still able to work. And I think he's feeling a lot more stir crazy because his stuff is more of a standstill. And that's been really hard.
You can only do cheese balls just for 100 days in a row before you go crazy, too.
Well, you know, that we kind of stopped the cheese ball videos just so that he could focus on some other things, because hopefully there will be some things coming in for him to work on. But, you know, like, we, you know, typically during the summertime, we'll go and we'll visit friends and we'll visit relatives and, you know, get out of the city for a little bit and really take advantage of all the things that the city has to offer during the summer. Like, we love to go up to the park and have picnics and with our friends. And a lot of it involves like socializing with other people. There's always like cool stuff going on in the city during the summertime. And admittedly, the city kind of clears out. So, you know, you kind of have it as your little playground. But right now, there's really no opportunity to do that if you are playing it safe, which we are. I know a lot of people are not, but we just can't. We both feel like it's just too risky. And we have a lot of friends who feel the same way. And even, you know, just all the really cool things that you would do during the summer are gone or in a stasis. Yeah, and yeah. So it definitely feels as if time is, I don't want to say wasting the summer, but you're missing out on one of the best times of the year to be here. And so there's definitely like kind of a mourning about that. And as I said, we're very lucky because we don't have some of the bigger, more horrible things that people are having to deal with. We have a lot of friends who are laid off and don't have income coming in. And that is like, you know, so I am definitely not complaining on that level at all. But I think that just as a society, there, like, sort of just the passage of time and the way that it's passing right now is truly bizarre and still strange for everybody to process. And I don't know. I wonder how it's going to be when we look back on this, if this is going to be sort of like the lost year. Hmm. Because as we're looking at it, you know, this is a situation that's probably not going to change at all until the new year. And even then, maybe into the new year if they find a vaccine, right? Mm-hmm. So we're then, all kind of, you know,
once we have
out
a vaccine, distributing it, that's not right. Going to happen overnight.
No. And depending on, let's hope it's like, we have no idea, as you know, like the accuracy and the matching with certain vaccines is just, it's not always 100%. So you also have that issue too. And, you know, they are rushing this particular vaccine studies. They're rushing it along in such a way, like there's like, I know one that they are basically doing, they went through like their first trial and it looked very promising, so promising that they are actually in tandem doing like with the next sort of level of testing and rounds of trials. They are in tandem already trying to create enough of a stockpile so they have enough. But if their gamble is not, you know, if they're gambling on the fact that it will be successful, but what if it turns out it's not, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I appreciate the fact that they're doing that, because basically they're like, well, it's promising enough that we're willing to do this, because if it gets to the point where we can get this distributed, we want to have enough that people can have it. But that the trials are just that. And if it's not successful, that's going to be kind of weird and a big waste. But let's hope they are successful. But anyway, it's all just us learning to sort of interact in different ways. And, you know, even with my job, we're trying to figure out new ways. And it's, you also don't know what's going on in everybody's lives. So in addition to learning how to work remotely, you also know that there's some people who have childcare issues, but also who are taking care of parents who might have had COVID or have lost people because of COVID. And they're not always necessarily being upfront about the fact that these things are happening, but they may be really struggling, and you kind of like are trying to check in on everybody to make sure everybody's okay. But also you don't want to get too, like, unless somebody wants to share that with you, you don't want to get too into it with somebody unless they feel like comfortable enough to share that. So there's all these things that are going on that's really just part of the new navigation, I guess, of all of this. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be, it'll be interesting, let's just say. I think it'll be interesting to sort of do a retrospective of all of this. And then not to, and again, I don't want to get too into the politics of this, but to me, one of the weirdest things about all of this is just what a big failure the government has been, the federal government has been in helping this. They've pretty much stopped almost all press conferences. Dr. Fauci has sort of been put in the corner, much like baby. You never put baby in the corner, but apparently you put Dr. Fauci in the corner. And there have been somewhat, like, I don't want to say rosy, but very positive rose-colored glasses-like press conferences with Vice President Pence, basically saying that we're all, everything's okay, and it's clearly not. So I don't know where we go from here. And that sort of conflict in messaging is, I think, going to come back to bite us, but we'll see what happens. I hope I'm wrong, but it doesn't feel like I am. And I think this is going to be a battle, especially for those states. Like, look, New York's where we are right now, but it's only because they did that full-throated, crazy response to all of this. And I do think that Governor Cuomo is more than willing to shut things down the minute something starts to look like there might be an issue. But, you know, at the sort of level of growth in Florida and Texas, I don't know how you get back from that, because it's just such a massive uptick in the cases. If you look at the curve, it's kind of terrifying. So I saw that California does have the uptick too, but it didn't seem, I mean, yes, it's large, but it's, it doesn't look, is it as dramatic as it appears to be? Or,
I mean, we've had the last week, what is, I feel like Newsom said this, in the last 2 weeks, we've had 25% of our total cases. So that's a big deal. And I don't know the nitty gritty of like where these, all of those new cases are happening, if they're spread out or if it's one specific area, AKA like Orange County, where people hate wearing masks. That's unclear to me, but I think it, honestly, I think it is Southern California that's getting hit the hardest.
I mean, I saw Mississippi was basically saying that the majority of the spread was being caused by frat parties. So
possible.
I don't know. I guess it's possible, but all right. Well, we'll keep an eye on this. We'll keep reporting back. Hopefully not too much, but today, why don't we get into our review? And I will admit, I finished binge watching this last weekend.
Okay.
So
you try not to get too ahead of yourself.
I'm gonna try not to.
We move into the Deadlands, I just want to point out two bright lights for me in media. While there is still media being released, I'm looking forward to July 31st because I think that's when Umbrella Academy Season 2 comes out on Netflix, which I'm excited for. Padma Lakshmi's Taste the Nation is this cooking show. People pan it because it's like a travel cooking show where she experiences culture through food, but it's actually about a person who's an immigrant to the United States, traveling around the United States, learning about how culture is assimilated and or, you know, held apart. And I think it's very timely, and it's a good show. Episode 3 is actually kind of set in Queens, talking about Indian food. It's a good show. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I've not watched it, but it actually was intriguing. I saw some of the teasers for it, and it looked really good to me.
I think it's good. Some people think that she's too, like, chill or something, or they say boring. they're like, this, she's never going to be Anthony Bourdain, and I don't think that's what they're trying to do. However, the final thing that was good, and this was good for the kids too, was The Floor is Lava, which is a game show on Netflix. I think it's the top show in the U.S. since it was released, and it's just an obscenely expensive looking game show where they put like goopy water, and then on the floor of a room, like deep, like a swimming pool of red water or goop, and then like there are chairs and tables that you have to jump around to get to the exit of. It's like an escape room. Anyway, It's been fun to watch. And, you know, mindless escapism, which I'm a big fan of.
Oh, yeah. Well, while we're talking about, you know, sort of positive things, I have been finding just in general, like having a harder time watching shows, just having the attention span to watch them. And I forced Bill Wadman to watch The Lost Boys last night in honor of Mr. Schumacher's passing. And I do think it's a different experience if you watched it when it came out, which was in the 80s, and now. He did not enjoy it as much as I did, but it was a little trip down nostalgia lane. So I've been doing some of that kind of thing. And then the other piece that I think you might enjoy, I don't know, maybe you would prefer the audiobook version, and I'm kind of, you know, I like both, but in this case I read the actual book. I've been reading The Address Book by Deirdre Mask, which is a nonfiction book about addresses, and it is basically punching every button for me in terms of my nerdy history, like loving self, basically. So it's just sort of in it, and it's honestly, I don't know that it could have come out at a better time, because I think it was released in April, and it's talking a lot about addresses and sort of the tracking of different diseases, specifically the very famous case of the cholera outbreak in London, when it was all coming from like the one pump, and that kind of thing, but also talking about addresses in a few different ways, both as ways that people can get services, like in Calcutta or Calcutta, which they're now calling it, just trying to like, how do you give addresses to people in rural places and then how they feel about it. It's so interesting that it's taking me a little while to get through it, because I keep looking up different things that she mentions in it, because it's fascinating to find out about it. But one of the more amusing sort of parts of it is that she talks a lot about like English slang, and how some things you wouldn't expect sound sort of innocuous are actually like pretty dirty if you're an English person. And so like there's certain street names that have either changed or evolved because of their original. I won't go into it here, but that's my little bright spot for the day.
Nice. Good to have those. Into these episodes, we are looking at episodes 3 and 4, but they actually have titles in this show, and I wrote them down, and now I don't know where I wrote them down.
But well, this one is The Kingdom at the End of the World, right?
At the Edge of the World, yeah.
Sorry, At the Edge of the World.
And then 4 is The Exorcism of the Boy. So here we go. We get to meet the boy in an opening scene of The Kingdom at the Edge of the World, as he is running through. Honestly, calling this guy a boy feels a little weird, because he is clearly in his 20s and is cut. He's built like a brick shithouse, as they say. He's a big fella, but I guess he is younger than Waka. But I mean, he might be the same age as Mehe, so I don't really understand why he's a boy.
Yeah, me neither. I was definitely also, when they kept saying that, I was like, I kept picturing somebody significantly younger, but I think maybe he's not tried in the way that Waka's been tried. And I actually did some research after our last episode just about you know, because how his face tattoos are actually like carved in, and apparently that is to denote the strongest warrior in a specific tribe, or in a specific sort of like village. So if they're etched in like that, it is supposed to signify that he is like a very powerful warrior. And in this case, the boy doesn't have really, he doesn't have the markings in the same way,
Doesn't have anything, does he? No
and of
tattoos.
anything, no. And so maybe that's sort of where they're coming from, and there might be a lot more in terms of like culturally what this means, and if there. And I do think, based upon what I was reading, there are certain rites of passage you go through at certain ages. So maybe that's what it's about. But I agree. I was like, I when they first mentioned him, I kept expecting to see somebody who was like 8 years old,
Is
right?
the boy
And this,
behind the large man?
yeah.
So we also meet Tejo and, oh, I forget what the other dude's name is. Tejo's soldier guy. And they are running through the forest. The boy is being chased by the, we assume zombies. We're hearing the yelling. And then they catch up to him and he's been got by some sort of critter that moves on the ground, like wind. 'Cause we see
Yeah,
him,
and I mean, I think that this effect is pretty good,
It's pretty
because
old
you can't.
school.
It's old school, but it's fun and it's psychological. And he's basically from the point, they both show the point of view of the person running and the point of the view of the whatever this thing is, and it gives you enough of a jump scare. It's effective. I liked it. But this is also getting into my, my little issues with the possession and exorcisms and things like that.
Oh, if you don't like
So
that, these are
admittedly,
not the two episodes for you,
oh,
obviously.
I know, believe me, I was having trouble with this. Maybe that's why I decided to binge watch others, was to sort of like try to get through this. This was, I did like, more of the Waka and Meihei interactions in this. And as we said before, this, the whole thing is that they're sort of, I don't want to say spirit quest, but this is a little bit of a quest for them. This is the next part of their journey. Again, it feels like a very mythological, like hero's journey, in that they are now onto the next level of it.
That
And
and
they've sort of,
Mehe's mom gives her that little carved pebble and is like, "This is your, I'm going to give you this protection against the witches because they're going to go see the three witches to ask about the boy." And it definitely, it's like straight out of one of the Ewok movies, right, where they all get a special magical thing and one of them gets a rock. But Mehe's like, she immediately recognizes this is a powerful piece of magic that her mother's given her, and she's like, "Well, I could share it with Waka," and her mom's like, "No, don't." Just underscoring that moms are the worst in this
Well, it's
series.
also, I mean, I think one of the things that that sets up and this whole thing sets up, so we have the spirits talking to Waka, potentially a god, we don't know yet. And all of these things seem to not be giving the best advice to Waka or to Meihei. And
Mehe's mom is actually still alive in this case.
she's alive, but I'm just saying, like, these authority figures don't seem to be giving the best advice.
No.
And so there is that piece. And I mean, the minute that piece of advice is dispensed, I think, as an audience member, you're like, oh, well, this is going to go wrong. And indeed, we definitely see Waka getting advice from his spirit guides or whatever they are, basically saying, no, oh, she's got this protection that she's not going to share with you. And his mom has him like, his mom is like a rough character.
She is
Like, she's
rough,
just,
man.
she has him drink something that's
Well,
disgusting.
her
So
blood
then
in
he'll
a
have,
skull mixed with
yeah.
water.
And there's a lot of like blood magic going on in this whole series, and a lot to do with the powers and the different things that it can give you. But anyway, so supposedly he has this protection, but also he now has distrust of Meihei. So he has like a seed of distrust that's been planted now. But basically, they're going to find this boy. And they're going, and sort of the way that it's been set up that I thought was interesting is that you hear that there's these three sisters and that they're witches, and you're scared of them because they're gonna hold power over you and cast spells over you. And so your initial, like, I think going into it, the audience and them and Waka and Meihei have this negative connotation, this negative idea of them. Because you also don't know why they have the boy. Like, there's this feeling that they are maybe holding him captive, that they're doing nefarious things. And So it's kind of an interesting precedent as they walk into this versus what happens when they walk out of
Yeah,
this.
because they go
So.
to the shaman for advice, and the shaman's like, "Well, I was gonna curse you to make your parts fall off or something. I forget what exactly what it was. It was something
Yeah.
bad." And then he's like, "Now I'm not going to because if you're going to see the witches, you're good as dead anyway." So clearly, yeah, more of this advice giving from the elders. Nobody should trust the shaman, her uncle, and so because we don't know if, yeah, like you said, there when at the beginning of the show when the boy is struggling with whatever possession he's encountered and the witches show up and appear to Teho, they're like, just bring him with us, bring him over into our area and we'll fix him up. So it's they seem to be on the up and up. They don't feel that sinister, but also Waka's been given that vision by his mother spirit in which he's bumping uglies with one of them and she actually kills him. So another point to underscore the distrust, and there's a lot of bad trust going on in this episode.
And that's the witch Hine, I think, that is sort of the seductress in that case. But there's also, like, especially when they go and actually interact with the witches, there's definitely so they're trying to get the name of the person who broke the world so that maybe they can fix it. But the witches are also kind of they are also in line with this endeavor, and so there is this idea that there is a greater good, even though people might have to get sacrificed to do it. And you know, the witches are talking about just their the things that have to happen that basically Waka and Mehei don't really know what's going on. They don't see the bigger picture, and they're trying to like show them the bigger picture. But then there's the whole, you know, the issue that you just mentioned, which is that Hine basically has this whole sort of sparring with Waka, where they end up they basically end up it's like a lot of like sexual tension. They end up on the roots of this tree, and she almost kills him, and he stops her, and she basically had been trying to ensorcel him so
Well,
that he was,
do you feel like that
you know,
was what
weak.
was? I feel like there was maybe some ambiguity there because she also says, like, they look at this tree root and it's covered in blood, and he's like, "Is this where you feed your god?" And I forget what the spirit that they serve has a name, and they say it a lot, but I've already forgotten it. Sorry. And she's like, "Only if you're willing." And then he lies down on the tree and he's like, "Well, I've been tired of this life for a while." And he's like, "I don't know if he is ensorcelled, if he's really just trying to get her to play her hand so that he can reveal that he knows that blah blah blah."
Well, I think she is trying to ensorcel him, and he is somehow immune to it.
Okay.
So I do think that
But it turns out
that's
later that he
part of
has no
it.
protection against sorcery because
Well,
the
right, but I
goats
think
the not the goat, the blood in the skull that tastes like bat
was
pee
actually goat piss.
or it's just like meaningless. Like there was nothing
Yeah.
to it. So he did it with his own willpower, which suggests to me that he was just going along biding his time and then catches her hand with the knife before she's able to cut his throat. Either way.
I either way, but I do think that there's some indication that he's got some sort of there is some reason why he is able to sort of navigate this stuff without becoming, you know, sort of under her power, because she does seem surprised when he's able to hold her off. But then we get into other stuff with Mehei, and these are the parts of the episode that I'm kind of like, because I think it ends with the fact that they're trying to get the boy back, like
Are
they're trying to find out what happened,
okay.
and basically these witches are withholding some of this information, and
Well,
it
they
turns
never
out
ask
that
them about it. Like this is the
no,
real
it's
problem, is
all
they don't
they're
even have
yeah,
like an
no,
honest
that's
conversation. They're like,
right.
what was even the thing they were trying to oh, they were asking about the boy, but they don't say why they want the boy, right? And so
Right.
they're not getting the information they want, and it seems like the witches are keep being mysterious and secretive instead of what they are, which is just like, "Hey, you can come stay with us. Take it easy, man. Stay out of the outside. It's dangerous out there." What's weird is that the witches, their sister just got abducted, and they're not talking about that,
Right.
and they don't seem worried about that. And Nwaka and Mehei aren't saying, "We're here to try and save the world, and do you know where that boy went?" Like
Right.
they don't
No,
do it.
so it feels like there's not like a ton of information that is being sort of passed between them. And also, it seems like there's a lot of time wasting because basically the boy is being taken, one of the witch sisters has been taken. And if they just told them that in the beginning, maybe they could have gotten a better heads up. But
And
in the
don't you feel
meantime,
like that could have helped also the pacing of this episode a little?
yes.
Like, it's not just a matter of, oh, these characters aren't interacting in a way that's annoying. It's like, well, let's hurry this up. All this back and forth in the hut is a little unnecessary, other than the fact that it leads to the it grows the distrust between Wakka and Mihe and leads to them being like, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. I'm still angry at you. There's a lot of that, which just gets a little tired.
And then, I mean, I think the other purpose or the other storyline they were trying to spin in this episode is that Mihe has some kind of spiritual gift or something because she's able to learn some of the craft that these witches have, which apparently is not, it's rare to be able to do this thing. So when they go chasing after the boy, she's able to protect them from some of these spirits or whatever is going on just by having watched Hine do this sort of
One time.
protective circle one time.
Yeah.
So there's that too. But, you know, basically, it feels like the pacing of this episode could have been better, and the communication between the characters, just in terms of storytelling, I think could have been a lot better. And I do feel like you and I are maybe at somewhat of a disadvantage in some ways because, or anybody who isn't maybe familiar with this culture, because I do feel like they're pulling on some specific themes that maybe we don't know. But I also think that if this is made for a general audience, you kind of have to spell out some of that stuff, that things that people might not be familiar with. But in any case, they end up with this episode having recovered the boy, and it turns out that he's being sort of taken to his father, and he is definitely still possessed, and there's definitely like weird stuff going on. And you know, as this is my creepy stuff that I dislike, and they do manage to capture him, I guess, or bring him back to the witches to basically help him get exorcised, right? But there's a lot of sort of just the effect of the whatever this spirit is taking him over. There's a lot of question about whether it's still in him. Wakka continues to say, no, it's still there and I can see it. It's hiding and that kind of thing. But ultimately, their big goal of bringing him back to the hut, it happens.
Yeah, but there's some good scenes though, because they catch up to them, and then there's like a face off between Tejo, who's this noble warrior that what's her name, Mihe, keeps talking about how he's a noble warrior, but him
And
and
she's related
Wakka,
to him.
yeah, they're cousins. Speaking of relations, the end of this second episode is a real head turner. But when Wakka and Tejo meet, Mei tries to defuse it by saying, "Oh, this is my slave," but turns out that was the wrong tack. But Wakka and Tejo immediately just want to fight. Like, that's all either of them want to do, it seems like, and it's kind of weird. And like you were saying, maybe this is something that culturally makes more sense, or is it just like the two toughest guys in the room want to like see who's tougher or something? But it feels a little
Well,
bit basic.
that's kind of why I brought up the markings on Wakka, because I think that that's in part why Tejo wants to fight him so much. And clearly, the minute his name is invoked, Tejo is like, "Oh yeah, we're totally fighting." And this is because, I mean, maybe there's like a whole dominance thing that if he can bring down a warrior like Wakka, his status is higher, or maybe
He
there is
talks about it
something
being about
within.
honor. It's all
Well, that I
about
was about to say,
this is a dishonorable man.
and if he doesn't challenge him, then what does that say about him? So there is that stuff going on too, which is kind of interesting. Ultimately, Tejo does not end up okay at the end of all of this, and he is definitely one of the sort of the victims of whatever this spirit thing is. There is also a lot that is at play in terms of sort of setting up the rules of these circles, the circles of safety. And it's, you know, there's very specific things like if the ash or the salt, whatever it is that's sort of laid along the ground is disturbed, it can come through. So it has to be unbroken for it to work. There has to be a blood sacrifice for it to work. Though it's unclear whether the blood matters, it seems like it matters who it comes from. And Mehe is royal blood. So, in any case, they are successful, but they've also now sacrificed one of these warriors. And the interesting thing that everybody brings up in this is just how the boy is being brought back to his dad, and that seems a lot more important than him being possessed at this point in time, right? Like, that's the goal, that he's like, I can't bring it back to the witches because I promised his dad I would bring him back. And it's sort of this indication that the father of the boy is a powerful chieftain, or
Well, if Tejo works for him,
hold.
yeah, you get that impression, right? Because Tejo seems like a
Right.
pretty powerful dude.
Right. So, you know, at the end of this episode, they've sort of reached their goal and they're bringing him back to the witches. And there's also like,
But
you know,
Waka
there
and
is a
Mehe
lot of.
are in full, like, not liking each other mode.
Yeah, they're in conflict, and you know, they're also arguing like the boy is weak, he's having a hard time, and you know, they're sort of going back and forth because he's definitely playing upon Mehe's like sensitive nature because she's worried he's going to get hurt, and Waka's like, no, he's just playing because this is the he's possessed. And so it's kind of an interesting thing because you have to figure out what's real and what's not. And there's, again, the storytelling I think could have been a little clearer, but at least we get to the point where they're back with the
Yeah,
witches.
and again, this episode drags. This is a draggy
A
episode.
lot. Agree.
The exorcism goes on for, I don't know, it felt like 3 hours.
Ever. Yes.
And you know, there are good stakes here. Like two of the witch sisters get taken out, which I'm like, we just
Yep.
saved one of them. Come on, do we have? Okay, well, she seemed nice. And Hine is the only one left. Meaning that Mehe, Waka, and Hine have to, like, all three of them lay hands on the demon and then go through some cut scenes that are in his head, overcoming
Yep.
the demon's truth telling and overcoming their own insecurities. And you know, for Mehe, it's that she killed her dad. For Waka, it's something about, yeah, I was a slave. And Hine, we don't get to see what her inner challenges were. I guess she just managed that one all by herself.
And there were a lot of questions. Both of these episodes I felt were a little bit draggy and just kind of kept going around in circles in ways that I didn't think totally made sense. And one of the things that definitely bothered me about it was that you set these witches up to be sort of, not sort of, but you set them up to be really powerful. You see that they are powerful. And it does say a lot about the fact that they can be broken by this or possessed by this or taken by whatever this spirit is, that it's that powerful. But to me, it doesn't totally match up with what you've seen about them because they've managed to hold this off for so long and up until this point. I also think they do a lot of contradictory sort of rulemaking here, so that they say to Mehe, don't come in, no matter what, don't come into this hut and don't look at this spirit in the eyes. And then she does, like multiple times. And Waka comes in and they don't really give him any sort of guidance, right? Like, so
I
it's
feel
sort
like
of like.
they're expecting Mehe to be, because she's already been taken in by his BS. Like, I think maybe that's
Right.
why that she's susceptible to his BS. And when she says stop the exorcism, and there's like doing some crazy yoga on this poor kid or
Yeah.
man, she's like, stop it, and they all stop. Like, they think that she's a source of authority for some reason. That's a little weird.
Yeah. Well, and especially when it's like they're just about to exorcise him,
He was
right?
about to give it
So.
up. It turns out there was a lot more to it than that. I don't know that they were going to be able to do it with the legs over the head move. But this episode just goes on too long.
Yeah.
The payoff is great, frankly. Especially
Yeah.
when once they get through the all the stuff with the quote unquote boy, who I hope will be a part of the cast for a while. I don't know if he's Uri. Yeah, his name turns out to be Uri, right? Yeah,
Yep.
he's in several episodes, so we might get to hang out with him for a while. He's like he gives up the name eventually after many, many hours of television. And he's like, it's my dad, who has a really long name and whose name I'm not going to remember how to say that one. And then Flippin' Waka goes to talk to his mom, and he's like, hey, it was my dad who broke the world, which means he's Uri's brother somehow.
Yeah, yeah. And then suddenly he's a lot nicer to him. But the other part of this episode, which I did think was pretty good, was that we have both Waka and Mehe going into this spirit world and basically going through these trials.
Yeah.
So they have to, like, you know, we have Mehe, which we knew she was kind of being, like, bothered by the, like, just tortured by the fact that she killed her dad. And then we also have Waka, who's really, like, he has, like, a weird conversation with his wife, who we had seen in the first episode and was never mentioned again. And he's really not, he's still not a nice guy. I mean, he basically says, "You're a horrible wife, but then again, I was a horrible husband." And it's basically the kind of spiritual journey that we've seen in other things, like trials that you've seen in other mythologies, where they kind of have to get through these different stages to get to the, I don't want to say the treasure, but to get to enlightenment. And in this case, it's finding out the name of the person who broke the world. And then that whole sort of reveal that it's Waka's dad was really good. It just felt like it could have been tied up a little bit neater, or been a little bit more faster, direct and linear in the telling. But
also,
it is,
we learned
nice
the name of the baddies. The baddies are called Mikeys.
Mm-hmm.
They're called Mikeys, and they work for a guy called Wiro, who is apparently the god of the underworld. Not surprising.
Yes. So he's like a Hades character.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we got. But it's really, you know, there were definitely some good acting in terms of in the spiritual world. I definitely say the guy who plays Uri does a great job
he
at
does.
Being possessed and creepy and scary.
He does.
You know, I definitely was like, ugh. So
must have been uncomfortable lying on that tree stump for the entire episode also.
I know. And then they keep pulling his legs behind his head. I mean, he's pretty flexible. But that is sort of where we're at the end of this. And I feel like it does reveal a little bit more about the mythology, but I wish it had done it in a slightly more direct way. So, but the cliffhanger was worth it, I think, because then that brings us to the next set of, like, journeying. And it's definitely, like, the whole Waka cliffhanger with his mom, or the reveal with his mom, was pretty good.
Bananas.
So,
yeah. And apparently the king had wronged his mother. His mother is like, yeah, you gotta go fix that because of what he did to me. So, of course, his mom
right.
is not
I mean,
a great source of anything. She lies a lot. She's always trying to get him to kill Mehe, and she makes him drink blood that does nothing. I don't know.
Well, there's also, like, some reveal in these episodes with the whole storyline that Mehe has kind of decided when she called him her slave, he got really worked up about it, and she does kind of get, she basically asks him, oh, well, you wouldn't be that upset about it if you, maybe it's because you were a slave or whatever. And so there's maybe a little bit more of a backstory there that we're going to get into.
Yeah, Teho had revealed some of that stuff in the cave before he turned into a zombie. Also, they had a fight, Teho, and Teho comes back as a zombie, and there's a whole fight on their way back to rejoining the witches, which is Teho's got a pretty cool fighting style. He uses, like, this pointy stick that's, like, not really a sword, not really a spear, but I don't know. It was a good fighting scene, and it was funny because Mehe's yelling at Waka, like, "You're embarrassing me! Do better!" Which I enjoyed.
Yeah. Like, I feel like they ended much more strongly than they began. So we'll see what happens in the next couple. Anything else to add?
Nope, that's about it. Yeah, I hope the next couple go a little faster. You've already watched them, and no spoilers, but I hope that they bring some more pep to their step.
All right. Well, I guess we'll find out next time.
Indeed.
So thank you all for listening, and if you have comments on these episodes or on the series as a whole, send us an email at reanimatedpodcast@gmail.com. Tweet at us, reanimatedpcast is the handle. Or you can leave a comment on our page, which is reanimatedpodcast.com. Yeah, until next time. Ciao.
Thank you. Bye-bye.